Happy December to all our AZMcast listeners. Welcome to part two of our review of the 2015 American Heart Association guidelines. Last month, if you were listening, we focused on what to do with patients who have died or are currently in the process of dying. If you haven't listened to last month's episode, stop this one, go back and listen to it. Or better yet, go read the guidelines themselves, or a textbook, or a novel, or just go outside, or excuse me. This month, we'll be discussing what to do with the people that you actually get back. Yes, Jared, Brian, and I discuss the updates on post-resuscitation care and acute coronary syndrome. Same insightful commentary, same crazy opinions, same tangential thinking. It's going to be awesome! And we have a peer review from one of our excellent alumni to kind of cap off the entirety of the American Heart Association guidelines that we have done. So sit back, enjoy a cup of eggnog, and away we go. Your eyes real nice and tight, Santa comes tonight. So, to round out, so we get them back because...
We do all this so that we can do early palliative care.
That's right. Yeah. Same time.
This is a dark episode, man.
Well, we're talking about death, man. I mean, we got dead people coming in. I mean, we're either grave diggers or we're resurrectors of the dead.
You say we're talking about death. I think we're talking about life.
Okay. Oh, gosh.
You're a syringe is half empty kind of guy.
If they're alive, Grandma would be talking to me, telling me about her cookies.
So, Grandma's back because Jared gave her vasopressin, and you pushed 5.5 centimeters on her chest. So now, what do we do post-arrest care? We talked about...
Put her on ECMO.
Call Jared.
Jared, I got somebody that came back. So honestly, post-arrest, when you get ROSC, that's really where I start to panic a bit. I'm not panicking during a code. You get ROSC, you're like, oh no, now I can hurt him, right?
Yeah, they become very difficult to manage. I mean, they have a profound shock. And, you know, there are some people who say... Is it sepsis that caused their cardiac arrest? Yeah, if you did blood cultures on all these patients, I think half of them have positive blood cultures. And the question is this. Did the sepsis cause their cardiac arrest? Or, what I think is more likely, they had their cardiac arrest, had poor gut perfusion and then translocation, and they got positive blood cultures from that.
Oh, yeah. That's the cause.
But regardless of the etiology, now they have... sepsis, right? They've got bacteria in their bloodstream and they have a SIRS response and cardiogenic shock on top of that. They become quite difficult to manage. On top of the fact that you're going to throw all the problems with hypothermia on there and you had your resident ramming around in the groin trying to get a central line and an A line and now they're coagulopathic. You're going to make them more coagulopathic with hypothermia. They have bleeding problems. They have hemodynamic problems. They have fluid shifts. I mean, they are quite difficult to manage. So, in all honesty, your best bet is to get them out of the ER because you're going to spend a ton of time in that room.
Now, wait a minute. I'm an ER doctor, and I was trained to care for critical patients, and you're telling me I should just boot them up to the ICU?
Well, I'm just telling you what you want to hear because that's what you want to hear.
That's exactly what I want to hear. I don't want these patients in the ER anymore. So post-arrest care, there are lots of variations of how this will go. The one thing that they came out in support of, nothing super mind-blowing, but don't cool or do cool, whatever you want to do. Just don't let them get febrile is the big thing that they pointed out. So fever, not good. Fever in traumatic brain injury, not good. Fever in post-cardiac arrest, not good. So you've got a sick patient, and I don't know, Jared, if they're burning extra calories, if they're causing a cytokine surge reaction, but fever itself is bad after an arrest.
I will say, you know, I don't want to sound like a ECMO basher because, again, that's what I do for a living. So I would say if you get ROSC and you have a profound shock in somebody that's survivable, that is a patient that I think is probably a good ECLS candidate for the reason being that we can precisely control their hemodynamics. We can precisely control their temperature. We can get rid of all that epinephrine you just gave them. And I think we can just let things chill a little bit until their heart starts to recover.
So another recommendation they made, post-arrest, please avoid hypotension, please avoid hypoxemia. So use the highest available oxygen concentration to give yourself a partial pressure of oxygen or a SAT that can be measured. So you want to get them to a reasonable level. I don't think these people need to have PaO2s of 700. I think they need to, you know, have a normal oxygen SAT, because if you get their blood pressure pushing it around, then hopefully you don't get the free radical damage.
Yeah, this is not the patient that needs a bunch of fluid either. This is the patient who has cardiogenic shock, right? They've got a sub 20% EF, stunned myocardium. This is not the patient that you volume overload, because they've already aspirated from your not intubating them during chest compressions. And now you're going to volume overload and give them ARDS, which is going to give them hypoxemia, which we just said is a bad thing. So this is a patient that is very tricky to manage, and this is where your bedside echo can help you tremendously.
So let me ask you, post-arrest, you want to avoid hypotension. So I have been in the habit of, we have ROSC, we have pulses back, someone make me up an EpiDrip.
Yeah.
And I almost always just start the EpiDrip. And only a handful of times have I ever had to turn it down or turn it off. But I get it started, and I'm almost always chasing my tail from the beginning and trying to titrate it up. Would you say it's reasonable to start your post-arrest patients on pressors right away?
I think it's a new game. Once you get ROSC, it's a new game, right? Now you have a hypoxemic, acidemic, cardiogenic shock patient who's got has a 50-50 chance of having bacteria in their blood and being CERSI at best, septic at worst. So now you have a whole new playing field. Forget about the cardiac arrest. Now it's, I have a patient in multiple etiologies of shock. So if they have a low SVR plus cardiogenic shock, an epi drip would be great. If their heart looks okay and they just have low SVR, norepinephrine would be fine. If their blood pressure is okay and their heart looks terrible on your bedside echo, dobutamine would be fine. So to me, it depends on what your bedside echo shows, what your hemodynamic profile looks like, how acidemic you are. If you're extraordinarily acidemic and it would take 10 of epi to do what 100 of levofed would do, I'd rather have 10 of epi. Right? Exactly. Dopamine is probably the worst one you could choose because of the arrhythmogenic effects of dopamine. Some cardiologists might disagree with me and say that levofed requires too much myocardial oxygen demand compared to dopamine, but the studies would show that dopamine is worse than levofed because of the arrhythmogenic effect.
Mm-hmm. Anything else you guys want to add on ACLS?
We don't really talk about the H's and T's and all that stuff anymore. My thought would be, you know, when a patient comes in, yeah, you're going to do CPR and epi and all those things, but you got to start ruling some of the things out that you can rule out right away, right? So, yeah, give some sugar, give some calcium, do those things that calcium's not going to hurt anybody. Sugar's not going to hurt anybody. I don't think an amp of bicarb's going to hurt anybody. I tend to just knock those out right away. Make sure you don't have a tension pneumo. Make sure you don't have a tamponade at your next rhythm check. And then you're just dealing with straight arrhythmogenic cardiac arrest.
Yeah, I do the same thing. And I make sure they're getting oxygen, which is the hypoxemia. And I give them a liter of warm saline to take care of any hypothermia, right, or volume if it was a sepsis cause or something, and just hit them all up front and then see where it all kind of falls out.
Yeah, one interesting thing is, now that we're all looking at people's hearts with echo, everyone thinks their patient has a PE and wants to give TPA, right? And so what I generally say is all bets are off once they've arrested. If a patient comes in with a cardiac arrest, you can't tell if their RV dysfunction is from a PE or from cardiac arrest. If you happen to look at it before they arrested and you see a blown out RV, then maybe thrombolytics is reasonable during that CPR event or that cardiac arrest event. But if a patient rolls in off the street and they've been getting 10 minutes of CPR and you look at their heart and their RV is blown out, I don't think you can tell whether it's from a PE or from cardiac arrest.
And I'm not a big TPA person or TNKs, any lytics for either MI or PE in these patients, because most of your patients are asystole PE. Most of your patients have been down at least 20 minutes and have been receiving treatment for 20 minutes and CPR, and they're coming into you and they're still doing CPR. You do get the, you know, less of your patients are a VFib arrest, less of your patients just went down, or less of your patients coded in the ED. But most of these patients have been down for a while, and so it doesn't make sense that now all of a sudden I'm going to give an agent that doesn't actively break down the clot but allows the body to break down the clot by blocking the clotting factor to all of a sudden fix the issue and even to get a little bit of oxygen or something by that. Now they're going to, it's going to offset any of the harms that I may cause with extra bleeding if I did get them back with all the needle pokes and the chest compressions, right, and everything else like that, plus the cost of the drug, right, to give it and to get someone to find them to give it in a reasonable period of time.
Right. Yeah. You know, the thing is, we sound like we're advocating just withdraw care on all these people, and I don't want to sound like that, because I am very aggressive when I care for somebody, right? I hate death. I'm scared of death. I will do anything I can to avoid death. So for the patients that I think might benefit from something, I am all for that. If research finds out that a patient comes in with cardiac arrest and you plug them into the matrix for a week, then that's great. But I also think we're hurting a lot of people. Right, we give people TPA, we make them bleed, give them brain bleeds. If they do survive, we put them on ECMO, we bankrupt their families and for something that they weren't going to survive from, or we put them in a state that they didn't want to be in. I mean, we save some people, but we also hurt a lot of people too. And so a lot of this stuff just needs to be studied more before we start advocating, give all these people TPA based on your bedside echo, put all these people on ECMO because you can, so on and so forth.
Right, and there's, I mean, you look at the numbers, it's just a number game, right? 8 to 10% out of hospital survival with neurologic outcome,
right,
all comers. Right, if you're taking eight, that's great. 90% of my patients are going to die when they have a,
right,
code. That's real.
You could make
it a numbers thing.
You could make it 100% ED survival if you do all these things that we're talking about, put them on ECMO and,
right,
all that stuff. But that doesn't mean it's the right thing to do.
Right.
To allude to what we did a couple months ago with chest pain, so they came out with some slight changes for acute coronary syndrome. Not a whole lot, but they did say they started to incorporate the high sensitivity troponins and some of the cardiac scores that we talked about.
You know, one thing I found interesting was that they kind of toned down the recommendation on who goes to the cath lab post-ROSC. It used to be everybody, and every year at SCCM in the lectures there, they say, oh, every ROSC needs to go to the cath lab because half of them have stent lesions. You know, back to our cardiac discussion, do you know, yeah, they have a stentable lesion, but does that mean that they just have bad protoplasm, or that stentable lesion caused their cardiac arrest? Who knows? But it seems that now they're saying, well, it's more of a judgment call if somebody goes to the cath lab or not. What do you guys think about that?
I think you can call cardiology if you get someone back and have the discussion with them. It doesn't mean they necessarily have to go to the cath lab. And it depends. I mean, what are you, you know, what's your goal with your care, right? Is this someone who you got Roski back because you gave him 3 tons of epinephrine and now they're just, you're like, this person's dying anyway. We just, damn it, we got a heart rate back. I got to deal with this now. And grandma's 95, as opposed to the younger patient who you do think you have a reasonable chance with getting the cath lab, and this is going to be a very good intervention for this person.
Yeah, I mean, my thought is if you have a bad protoplasm person at baseline and you get ROSC back and they're on 3 pressors and they're in multi-organ failure, fixing their 70% RCA lesion is probably not going to be the thing that turns them around. But if you've got the guy who's running the marathon and has the cardiac arrest and gets ROSC back within a few minutes and has no other injury except his MI, that patient probably should go for early PCI.
He should be the next person on the table.
Here's what's tough, though, is how many of you have had the paramedics come in and go, we have a 54-year-old gentleman with a history of coronary artery disease and diabetes who clutched the left side of his chest and then had a witnessed VF arrest. He got shock from an AED by a bystander, and his cath report, he was holding in his hand at the time that he went down. It was performed 3 months ago. I mean, we don't know. So what are you going to do? You're going to throw a 12 lead on this patient after they have arrested, and what are they going to have? Diffuse infarct, and you go, well, I don't know.
Yeah,
what was the cause?
Yeah, but if you have somebody that comes in and they've got a fistula in their left arm, and they've got a huge barrel chest because they smoke 100 packs
of
cigarettes.
50 pounds, and their hair is gray or gone.
Exactly. Or they're icteric.
Their hair is gray and gone, huh? Yeah.
Mine's gone.
They're icteric because they've got chronic liver disease or whatever. Maybe that person doesn't need early cath.
Correct. Yeah, and so I think that's what Brian made the point of call cardiology if you're concerned. But yeah, a patient who goes down and you get their K back and it's 9, well, I think we got a reason. If you don't have a reason, you know, maybe that's a legitimate thing to go in and see if they have a lesion. Yeah. Cardiology is going to stent it if it's there.
You know, the other thing is you were talking about following the money. I had a conversation with one of our cardiologists recently, a post-arrest patient, multi-organ failure, 4 pressors. I'm like, oh, why don't you take this patient to the cath lab? I mean, he's just a disaster of a patient. And he was saying that now cath lab outcomes are publicly reported. Just like a cardiac surgeon's outcomes are publicly reported, so some cardiac surgeons aren't going to do the high-risk CABGs and stuff like that. Now you're going to have some cardiologists who are not going to take those higher-risk patients to the cath lab because it's publicly reported. And if they have a bunch of people that they're more aggressive and will take them to the cath lab and those patients die, their numbers look bad. Ergo, their reimbursement might get dinged or they might not be in the good graces of the hospital if that happens. So it's interesting that there's more than one motivation behind some of this stuff.
I think it's selectively choose your patient. Your V-fib arrests, more likely to go to the cath lab. Those with ST elevation on a post-EKG.
How many post-EKGs have you seen that don't have ST elevation?
A lot. There's a lot that you get. They don't have ST elevation.
Wait, how can you tell post-arrest rhythm?
You get a left bundle on lots of these people, and they have a left bundle with no Scarbosa criteria.
Post-arrest rhythms are difficult to interpret.
They are. But there's a lot that don't have them, right? What's the agonal rhythms? We have most arrest is PEAA systole. Mm-hmm. So you get someone back, you're probably in some Brady tachy that really isn't a STEMI. They died from some other cause. We just don't know what that is. And now we have them back. Now we don't know what to do with them.
So one of the first cardiac issues they talked about is that you can use a high-sensitivity troponin and trend it over 2 hours to predict a less than 1% chance of 30-day major cardiac event. And that is in conjunction with the TIMI score, which I still think TIMI score, ironically, it says over 30 days because TIMI score predicts your mortality within 2 weeks or morbidity. Just by me applying this score, you now have a 5% chance of death. So, but apparently if you trend this, I think that they say that you can decrease your mortality.
This makes no sense.
Thank you.
What? Hello, soapbox. Yeah. Here we go.
Why? You have somebody who has died that you have brought back from death. And you're going to try to predict their future risk of death.
No. This is just acute coronary syndrome.
Acute coronary syndrome. We're off death.
Okay, all right.
We have live patients. All right. We're going to reset for Jared. Jared, we have live patients now.
Okay.
With possible this thing called acute coronary syndrome. You may have heard of it. It's unknown what it truly means, but it's a vague term because it's a syndrome.
Right. And so now we're going to trend troponins.
We're going to trend everything. Because we want a death less than 0.00000%. Otherwise, we're all sued and dead.
Okay. So with that in mind, so we can use this, we can use the high sensitivity troponins as long as we trend them over 2 hours. We can use regular troponins if we trend them over 3 to 6 hours and incorporate something like the Vancouver score or the North American chest pain score to predict a less than 1% chance of major adverse cardiac event in 30 days. They basically did not say anything at all about using one troponin, but they did say, if you're going to use a troponin, you need to trend it. Are you still going to use one troponin for anybody?
Yes. I think these recommendations are goofy. and don't make a lot of sense. The first off, high sensitivity troponins, we know, are the next coming of the devil. But we have not accepted that, and we still want to study it more because we weren't happy with D-dimer. We haven't been happy with procalcitonin. We weren't happy with BMP. So we want another nonspecific marker that will include everyone that comes up with some pathway and some heart score or some other scoring system that's going to tell us nothing that we don't already do.
You could combine it with lactate.
We could combine this with lactate.
I mean, and a white blood cell count.
And a white blood cell count. And it just, I mean, it's, what does Alma Matu say?
The CBC is the last bastion of the destitute?
The intellectually destitute, yeah.
But let me ask you this. Okay, so I got the bullet in the chamber, and I get my one troponin, and I send somebody home and say, you're not just a low-risk, but you're a no-risk patient. One troponin, because I still don't believe that you're a no-risk patient, and I'm going to send you home. And the gun goes off, and I lose, and the patient has a cardiac arrest or has a massive MI. And I get hauled in front of the jury or the state medical board, and they print off this document published in October of 2015, and they say, here are the guidelines for your specialty, and you did not follow them. How am I going to respond to that?
I would say that these are not the guidelines for my specialty. They're the guidelines of the American Heart Association and not my specialty guidelines. And the guidelines change all the time. So the other thing is, right, what is that patient? So if I have a patient with 1 hour of symptoms, then, yeah, I don't think a single troponin is appropriate. If I have someone with 72 hours of symptoms that has been constant, I'm not going to sit there and trend their troponins for a 72-hour symptoms. There is, right, a troponin should, the whole point with these high sensitivities or regular troponins, they will peak at a certain time. They should be positive at a certain time. So if someone's had 8 hours of symptoms, they've been consistent, they're not popping, they, to me, can go home.
I don't disagree with you.
There's others in our specialty that will back you and will back you in court.
I don't disagree with you, but there's also plenty in the specialty and in cardiology that will fry you for this. And so I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm just saying, how is one supposed to defend themselves from that?
Funny that you would mention that, Jared, because as I was recording the peer review last month with Peter Rose, and he actually had a very amusing anecdote about just that. Actually, didn't find it all that amusing, because I actually found it a little bit scary. But I'll let Peter tell the story and you be the judge.
This is a true case. There was a very good plaintiff attorney in Denver, Colorado named who was actually a terrific lawyer and a very interesting man. He, very smart man. He subsequently became dean of the law school there. And he was a very effective plaintiff attorney. So he was suing a cardiologist. I don't remember what the details of that case were. But during the case, developed chest pain and had a cardiac arrest right in court. Cardiologist got off of his witness chair, resuscitated him, saved his life. They recessed for a couple of weeks. He came back and he went on with the trial and defeated the cardiologist. And as I was saying before, what does that say about the jury that can sit there and watch this doctor do a very dramatic thing and then find him guilty of malpractice?
Sometimes you can't win.
Well, I think it helps us to separate the practice of law from the practice of medicine. They're two different entities. And trying to outguess the practice of law is futile anyway.
Just wow.
My take on this, all of these Vancouver scores, heart scores, all of these other scores are basically identifying patients at so low risk that I wouldn't have gotten a troponin on them to begin with, so I just don't. I think you can say, you know, I had some inkling it might have been cardiac, so I got a 12 lead EKG that looked normal, and I said, be done with it. You know, that's all. What I have been telling the residents that have been working with me on those two adult shifts that I work every month is, do you think this guy's got acute coronary syndrome? No. Well, then why do you want a troponin? Well, because he might. But you just said he doesn't. Well, but he might. I go, you got to, like, decide for yourself in your own clinical gestalt who you're going to do, because if you suddenly increase your prevalence of who's possibly got this disease, you just start testing randomly, you're going to get these weird numbers. You're going to get those troponins of 0.04 that you go, great, now what do I do? Have I just doomed you
to the next year of cardiac procedures because I thought to check a troponin.
But 0.04 is red. When you look at the result, it's red.
And there's a there's an exclamation point with an arrow that points up. So a lot of times I say, I just don't want to know. I just don't want to know. And so if the story is, I'm 28 years old, but I had this sudden onset of crushing substernal chest pain that radiated to my left jaw and radiated down to my arm, accompanied by diaphoresis and nausea. Look, I know you're only 28, but that's kind of freaky. Right.
And I've been diabetic since I was three.
Yeah, that's kind of a freaky story. I'm a little worried by your story. Let's go ahead and look at it. And then I'm just going to look at it. I'm going to actually trend it. If you say I'm 78 years old and I felt this brief twinge of like chest pain on the right side of my chest that then shot down to my left knee and then went up to my eyeball, I'm going to go, All right, that's kind of weird. I'll get an EKG to make sure, you know. Or the one I like is I have a history of pancreatitis, and this feels like my pancreatitis pain. It's epigastric. Let's get some troponins to make sure that it's not actually an ACS. I think you got pancreatitis.
Well, anytime you expand your tests, right, tests are there for areas of clinical uncertainty that you have. If you know that this person had 1 second of pain that went from their chest to their shoulder to their knee to their butt, it's probably not a heart attack. You know that. You don't need a test to tell you that. The test is only going to get you in trouble. So you're testing these people that you're worried about. And there are some people that are no risk, or we could say very, very low risk, and there's low risk patients. And you can say, well, am I going to hold up in court? And, you know, we can go down the medical legal rabbit hole with some of this stuff, but that also requires, if you have a good conversation with your patient and explain your risks and benefit, do some shared decision making, what the harms of the tests are, and we really don't have a good test to really find out if you have disease, and what if we do a test and we cath you and we're going to cost money and you may not have a lesion that's really causing your symptoms, but we're going to open it anyway. And so if they're like, I don't want this test, I want to go home, I document that in my record and I have one troponin and I go home. Whereas opposed to, you know, taking two troponins, I never talk to the patient, and I just send two troponins and I discharge them. You know, there was recent, I think I mentioned this one before, but had a decision instrument with pictures for patients, and they would show the patients these decision instruments and like what the percentage was, and showed it in pie graphs and charts, and what would you like to do? And they had a very well thought out, documented shared decision making model, had the patient even sign it and say, yeah, I agree to this plan. I don't need risk stratification. Or I want a stress test and I want to do it within 72 hours. Great. That's the plan we're going to do together. And so I think doing something like that is better than just worrying about, did I order the test? How many hours apart are they? What is the reasonable thing to do next? And so, and knowing that, again, with all this testing, we are really good at this, right? The Pope article told us in 2000 that we are really good at acute coronary syndrome. We are only missing 0.3%. Now, when they throw in these, you know, major adverse cardiac events, they're throwing like someone reinfarcted, which means just a bump in their troponin. So if they were 0.04, they went home, and the next time they came in, it was 0.10, that counts as a major adverse outcome. It doesn't mean the patient had an outcome. It just means the number changed.
Jared, you mentioned, you know, we bankrupt all these people trying to get them back with ROSC. I mean, I'm sure that we set people down a similar pathway when we check tropes on everybody that comes in with a chest. And Peter Rosen has said before that patients are less likely to sue the kind doctor that sat down with them and held their hand and tried to explain stuff to them. They're more likely to sue the doctor that did everything right and was really, really rude to them and that they didn't like, even though everybody can defend a medical legally, but there was going to be a bad outcome. So I think that advocates for spending a little bit of time at bedside with your patients.
Well, to be fair, they might not like you because of the outcome. Not necessarily your bedside manner. I mean, in a perfect world, yeah, that's great. You sit there, hold their hand, have a conversation, everything's great. But there are times where they just don't like you because of the outcome is not one that they would like.
Medical legal is tough, man. So the very last thing that AHA decided for as far as ACS goes is cath or transfer. Cath them if you got them. If you don't got the facilities to cath, then transfer to cath. Really withhold fibrinolytics for those patients that you are not going to get to the cath lab in a reasonable amount of time.
Yeah, this is one question I'd like Clay to chime in on if he's doing the peer review this month, you know, or whoever's doing the peer review. Do you lyse and transfer if they're not going to make it there within 90 minutes, or do you just transfer? And who do you transfer?
Well, I know, at least for myself and the private practice, and when I was out there, it would be based on EMS's response time and whether we could get them to the cath lab, plus patient symptoms. So the longer patient had symptoms, the more likely we were to get them to cath. Because if you look at the evidence, right, most people, lytics work, and they probably work better than cath in the first 30 minutes. So if I started having an MI right now, I'd almost say, give me some lytics, open up the clot. Because yeah, by the time you put a cath in me and take me to the cath lab and figure that out, give me the damn lytics right now.
I'm going to clip that just so we have Brian saying, give me the lytics. And we'll just use it out of context for the rest of the time that we have this podcast.
Oh, boy. I'm in trouble now.
But I want that to be my text alert.
Give me the lytics. Give me the lytics.
But yeah, so I think if the longer they've had symptoms, the more willing I was willing to wait and transfer them as opposed to giving them the lytics immediately. But if they had an hour, 2 hours of symptoms and it was going to be a 2-hour delay by the time they got to the table, I would give the lytics. And also, you can have that conversation with the accepting cardiologist. So if you don't have a cardiologist in your hospital or you're transferring them to that lab, hey, here's our transfer time. I can give lytics right now, or we wait until you're available. Mm-hmm. And you have that discussion, and if both of you agree, that's easy. Then your answer.
What if it was, let me give you two scenarios.
Yeah.
Scenario one is patient comes in, chest pain for 2 hours, you're 2 hours from a PCI facility, they're pain-free with a nitro drip and some morphine. Do you lyse that person or not?
They have ST segment elevation.
Yeah.
Once they're pain-free, I wouldn't.
Okay, but if scenario two is nitro drip, not pain-free,
I would lyse them.
Okay.
Because if it's 2 hours to that facility, it's still going to take some time to get them on the table, to get to that vessel and open it up. And again, 2 hours of symptoms, much better than the person, 10 hours of symptoms. Mm-hmm. I may wait on that 10-hour patient as opposed to the 2-hour patient. Mm-hmm.
So American Heart continues to comment on lots of other stuff, such as hypoglycemia and dental avulsion and use of C-collars.
Did they comment on rattlesnakes 1 year?
1 year they did, and I believe the toxicologist just about had a major adverse coronary event when that happened. So they comment on all kinds of things that I guess, you know, the blood is pumped by the heart to these different areas, but you know they're American Heart. They comment on lots of other stuff, but the stuff that we kind of want their input on and to help set the guidelines for what the rest of research is going to be for the next 5 years is most of the stuff we talked about. Next month, I'm going to talk with one of the authors. Hopefully, talk with one of the authors for the pediatric section about some of the changes with PALS, because there's been some interesting stuff. So all in all, lots of, you know, minimal changes that have kind of been on the block for a while. It's nice to see them come out in support of some of the things. And then there's definitely a lot of vagueness that they just can't make a firm stance on because we don't have the firm evidence for it.
My quality control captivates your party patrol. Your mind, body, and soul, for who the bell tolls.
Hi, my name is Clay Josephy, and I graduated from the U of A program in 2010. I am a big fan of the AZEM cast. I listen every month, and so when Jared and Aaron asked me to do a review, you know, what they're calling the peer review, I was honored, and so I thought I'd give it a go. And then they sent me the topic, the AHA Guidelines 2015, and I was thinking to myself, wow, what an easy topic. It's very simple. So, most important rule of emergency medicine is to know when to call for help. And so, I did just that, and I would like to invite my friend Mike McLaughlin here.
Hi. Thank you, Clay. My name is Mike McLaughlin. I am also a graduate of the University of Arizona Emergency Medicine Program. I graduated 2 years earlier in 2008. I do have the distinction of being Clay's attending for 1 year.
Exactly. So, if I say anything dumb, it's because he taught me everything I know. Him and Mike Hudson. All right, so first of all, where do we work? The two of us are both in private practice. We work in small community hospitals. We work in two hospitals. One of them is a little busier. It's a 20K visit, level 3 trauma. We have about 13 beds plus hallways and chairs, usually single coverage, but we do have a daily backup doctor between 10 and 10. So sometimes it's two docs, but it's mostly one doc. And specifically overnight, it's one doc. We do not have PCI. We have no intensivist service, very limited to IR. No neurosurgery. So we do a lot of transferring for sick cardiovascular patients.
The second facility is even smaller. It is a rural critical access hospital. I believe the annual volume is somewhere in the 10 to 12,000 patient per year.
Yeah, something like that.
It's always single coverage. We respond to floor codes. After banker's hours, we are the only doctors in the hospital for the most part, in addition to the hospitalists at times. So we're making all the decisions and we end up transferring most of our critical patients.
Right. And so that's the perspective that we're trying to do here. You know, working alone and not having the end goal care available at your hands, it just kind of changes some of the perspective on some of these guidelines. So just to start off, before we kind of start picking you guys apart topic by topic, I do want to say what a great job reviewing this. I mean, this is a very tough topic. There's lots of controversial areas. Definitely had some ranting going on there, which I think is, you know, pretty appropriate for this level of a complex type of knowledge base that's kind of boiled down to a guideline. So, you know, the one thing I do want to start with is just like a small comment about guidelines in general, because I think it's easy to be very critical of these guidelines. And in the past, I have been personally very critical of them.
I've become a bigger fan of guidelines the further away I am from residency. I don't have access to a PubMed account. I can't read all of the papers on my own. And when I'm approaching a topic and I want to learn about a topic, when I want to do the quote unquote deep dive, I always start with the guidelines and then go from there. And for 95% of practicing physicians, the guidelines are going to tell you what you need to know, and you're probably not going to look a whole lot further. I think the guidelines are very important, and they certainly need to be dissected and criticized by people with the expertise to do so.
Yeah, guys like you.
Exactly.
Not like us.
But I truly appreciate guidelines, and I do think that these guidelines did a really good job of trying to simplify things, but at the same time allowing leeway for clinical judgments. And I think that a lot of these changes and updates kind of trend in that direction.
So let's jump right into it. Intra-arrest care. We're going to talk a little bit about intra-arrest care and some of the things that you guys brought up. The most important aspect of cardiac arrest care is risk stratification. And how do you decide who to be aggressive with and who not to resuscitate at all?
Whether or not somebody's going to do well in a cardiac
like favorable
arrest
characteristics
depends so much upon static factors that you as a physician cannot change. How old a patient is, was it witnessed, did they get bystander CPR, was it a cardiac event? The people that I really think that we're going to have a chance of saving, by the time they arrive to me, they should hopefully have a pulse back. We do
hopefully,
work in a rural area. We have some prolonged transport times. And if the patient has been pulseless for 20 minutes by the time they arrive in the emergency department, you know, unless it was a witnessed V-fib arrest, when they bring me in the, you know, questionably witnessed asystolic arrest that they've been working on for 20 minutes, I put the ultrasound on, I might give them another round of medications just to give it the old college try, and then I call it.
Yeah, and I'm the same. I like to look at this maybe a little bit backwards. What are the favorable characteristics for ECPR or ECLS? Or what are the favorable characteristics to go to cath after cardiac arrest? Less than 75 years old, witnessed VF arrest, short intervals to CPR, refractory arrest, you know, following ROSC in the field or even in the ED. You want to get that information within the first minute.
Absolutely. You need to grill the paramedics.
Yeah.
Just like everything in medicine, the history is paramount. So it's really, really critical to gather that information, write it down on a whiteboard if you need to, just to keep it straight in your mind, because that in my mind is going to determine what I do next.
If they don't have these favorable characteristics coming through the door, I tend to do very little, because I can't, you know, do a mechanical thumper and transfer someone 2 hours so they can get put on ECMO. I guess in the community or as a solo provider, I really focus on that in the first couple minutes. And the other thing, it's like, I don't think that we should be nihilistic about cardiac arrest in general. I mean, if you look at the survivals with favorable neurologic outcomes, we are making progress, and a lot of that has to do with some of these kind of nuances that we pick apart. So moving on, let's just say, you know, we've decided we're going to work somebody. I mean, you guys talked about a lot of topics. The next topic that I wanted to address is inter-arrest monitoring. How do you quantify the quality of your CPR or the quality of your resuscitation when you're all by yourself? Just specifically, you know, I agree with Jared. Like Jared says, you know, hey, when everyone else is screwing around doing this and that, I slip an A-line in. I would love an A-line on every cardiac. How many A-lines do you pop in your cardiac arrests all by yourself, Mike?
The answer is zero.
Zero.
I don't have the time, the manpower. I need to be focusing on directing the resuscitation.
Cognitive.
Slapping in an A-line is something I'm not going to do in the initial arrest. So I'm eyeballing the person who's doing CPR. Does it look like it's the appropriate rate, the appropriate depth? If I can feel a good femoral pulse during the CPR, I like that. If you actually can see a pulse ox waveform, that to me indicates that you're getting good CPR, although it certainly doesn't rule out good CPR if you don't have a pulse ox waveform. But these are just the things I'm looking at, and it's a judgment call. Yeah. I'm certainly not out there with the ruler measuring depth, and I'm not counting, you know, compressions to the,
recoil,
to the second.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
But does it look appropriate? If so, I'm going to continue it, and I'm going to think about what I need to do next.
I do want to point out that in a solo operator shop, and you're the only guy in the room, the leader and also the interventionalist, to me, chest compressions is probably the single most important part of controlling a code and making sure that you're actually doing probably the most important thing correctly. And I find that I need to kind of hawkeye the compression person quite a bit and provide feedback to them. And so I was a little surprised that you guys didn't talk a little bit more about end-tidal CO2. I understand that it's not the panacea of intra-arrest monitoring, but when you're by yourself, it's super easy. I mean, the medics, it's mandated for pre-hospital care. They all come in on end-tidal CO2, and yet occasionally, you know, we de-emphasize the end-tidal CO2 when they come into the ED, whereas in my mind, it's the first thing that I focus on is, like, get them on the end-tidal CO2 so I can see it. For me, it gives the compression person something to focus on. I'm like, look at that number. Okay, now it's 12. Get it to 15. You know, and that's, like, the way that I can give the chest compressions some real-time feedback so that I can monitor without having to stand there and stare at the person doing chest compressions. There's more to the end-tidal CO2 as well in terms of identifying ROSC, you know, and these things are all in the guidelines, and there's, you know, three sort of mandated things: tracheal intubation confirmation, identifying ROSC, and then the third thing, of course, that they recommend is using it for an assessment of your quality of CPR. So I just can't speak highly enough about end-tidal CO2 and cardiac arrest when you're by yourself. It's like a third eye.
I agree. I think end-tidal CO2 is very valuable. I don't always use it on an intubated patient. Most of the time, the patients in an arrest are going to come in with an extraglottic airway. Until we have a definitive airway, I'm okay with using the end-tidal through the extraglottic device. I know that the guidelines don't 100% support that. But again, for a single provider, realistically, that's the best that I can do. I don't use it as much, in my experience, to gauge the quality of CPR. I certainly use it to call a code if somebody's had, you know, a number between 0 and 5 and you're 20 to 30 minutes out. It makes me feel better about calling a code. I use that in conjunction with ultrasound and just the whole story. You want all the objective information that you can get, and end-tidal is a really easy thing.
Yeah, so I'm a big fan of that for all those reasons. Which, you know, you brought up a really good point. When do you do an airway, and how do you feel about extraglottic devices? If they come in with bag mask going on, I put a King in until ROSC. I like the aspiration protection. I think it's probably enhances, you know, ventilation and oxygen delivery. So I'm a fan of extraglottic devices. Being alone, they're super quick. I don't even have to look.
Every case is different. If you think it's a primary respiratory arrest, I might just try to intubate the patient right away. If it's a kid, then yeah, I'm going to go ahead and try to get an airway right away. And one more thing, just being realistic, it is a chance for, you know, a single provider who doesn't do a lot of airways to do an airway. It helps you keep up your skills.
That is true.
I know that nobody wants to say that, but, you know, sometimes I will do an intubation in these codes, even if the prognosis is dismal. That being said, I don't focus on the airway.
Yeah.
I focus on getting the pulse back, restoring circulation.
And I'm the same way. As soon as we get ROSC, though, I definitely swap out to an ET tube. I guess I am a little concerned about these, you know, pigs with their decreased carotid flow.
Well, you know, weren't the pigs the one that they had the interrupted chest compressions?
Yes.
And everybody was so concerned if you stop chest compressions for 5 seconds, and then there's this large RCT that just comes out in the New England Journal of Medicine. I know that both groups were getting good CPR, but, you know, taking a second or two to pause and give a breath, I guess that's
study didn't show much of a difference.
Maybe
in
not so yeah. important, but you know, I do think that minimizing interruptions and chest compressions is is another real key feature for solo practitioner. What kind of things do you do to minimize interruptions in chest compression? I mean, do you do like standard pulse checks every whatever minutes? And
I really try to do those 2 minute cycles at least.
I'm going to be honest with you, I don't really do pulse checks. You know, I do the first pulse check after like my 2-3 minute sort of prognosis time where I decide if we're going to go to town. I stop everything, I take a pulse check, and then I slap the ultrasound on, take a look, and then from there on I kind of focus on the end-tidal CO2. I might stop briefly to look at the rhythm, and if the rhythm is reassuring, I might actually feel for a pulse. I do my best to keep the chest compressions going the whole time.
Yeah, agreed. You know, you need to identify V-fib.
Okay, and then the last couple things that you guys mentioned as far as intra-arrest care is this whole idea of dropping vasopressin off, you know, whatever. My personal opinion is I think it's a shame that they removed it from the guidelines, because now my hospital is going to remove it from the code cards. And the other thing is that we respond to in-hospital cardiac arrest. Maybe we should be giving solumedrol and vaso and epi to those patients. I mean, what do you think about that?
In-hospital cardiac arrest, certainly. I think until there's some data to say otherwise, it seems pretty reasonable.
Absolutely. And, you know, and it kind of brings up the question of, like, are some out-of-hospital cardiac arrests, you know, similar to our in-hospital patients? You know, I always think about these, like, chronic, you know, COPD, chronic steroid use, comorbidities, you know, when they come in PEA or you know, non-shockable, you know, cardiac arrest, like, should they be getting VSE? So anyway, that is what it is, and I think like most of us probably agree that it's probably a simplification mechanism.
I gotta say, I use it extremely rarely.
Yeah.
I'm not gonna miss it at all.
So that kind of brings up the next question you guys talked about later on, about PEA and a systole.
Yeah, I've heard the MRAP talks about, you know, wide versus narrow, but I mean, there's a few things can treat pretty quickly. Hyperkalemia, if it's truly PEA and not just a systole with an agonal rhythm. But if it's truly PEA, then I give them calcium.
Sure.
I give them an amp of bicarb. If they haven't checked a blood glucose, I'm just going to go ahead and give some glucose. If there's any remote possibility of an opioid overdose or intoxication, I'm going to go ahead and give some Narcan.
And there is always a remote possibility.
Yeah. My last arrest on my last night shift turned out to be just that, a heroin
Narcan
overdose.
Responsive?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
The guy left AMA after a cardiac arrest.
I also give a lot of these meds, and sometimes I feel guilty about it, and sometimes I don't.
I think you need to at least consider it. You always need to consider these causes of PEA. So those things are pretty easy to either empirically treat for or look for on the ultrasound. I'm only going to give intra-arrest lytics if the history strongly suggests pulmonary embolism. You know, if it's somebody who's out from surgery and has a hugely swollen leg on one side.
You get a right bundle back on your 12-lead.
Exactly. Called for shortness of breath, and maybe I'm going to consider it.
Yeah.
So I'm a kitchen sink guy short of intra-arrest lytic. I am going to lice the patient where they have an arrest. I've had that several times where, you know, somebody walks in the door and within 15 to 20 minutes, sometimes within seconds, they just die.
Yeah, you get a pre-arrest 12-lead and you got
right. This is the patient with the pre-arrest 12-lead who has a STEMI.
Yeah.
And then the minute you make that diagnosis, they go ahead and code right in front of you. I mean, I'm gonna work that patient, but I'm gonna lice that patient as well, because I'm not gonna wait to get that vessel open. I'm gonna do what I can to open that vessel.
So moving on, we'll talk real briefly about post-arrest care. I don't really have a lot to say about this, except as it applies to us trying to get these patients to the right place, because I mean, that can be insanely difficult. You guys talked about cooling. You know, I think Mike and I agree that we will absolutely use some ice bags and cold saline. I really emphasize that. I like to get an accurate temperature probe in and really know what the temperature is doing, and I try to stay vigilant about it, but I don't I don't use devices or anything.
I leave the definitive cooling measures to the receiving facility.
Absolutely.
But I think it's something that we need to initiate.
You know, this ECLS business, you know, Jared, and you guys talked about this at some with some detail, and I totally agree. I will say this. I have had cases, and they come back, and they're in shock, and they're, you know, just super sick after ROSC. I wish that I had a portable ECLS machine, you know, to get them to cath, and I do believe that that's the future, so I do appreciate people who are aggressively doing research on this, and I think that it should be used widely in a research setting. I'm excited about some of the observational data with ECLS and ECPR, and I hope that someday it trickles down to me. So let's move on to the topics that really matter for us. Chest pain, risk stratification.
I think just the mention in a guideline from the American College of Cardiology that
two troponins and some kind of low-risk decision tool, you know, to essentially give you a low risk of major adverse cardiac events is huge.
The mace.
What that says to me is that they're sort of saying that you don't need to admit all these people and give them a stress test.
Yeah.
You know, coming out and saying that in a guideline to me is huge. So I thought that that was actually quite important, whereas Jared and Aaron, not as much.
Yeah, but you know,
that to me was really big, because I think that's just one step in this movement forward of not having to admit everybody and put them on a treadmill or give them a nuke scan.
I tend to do more of a 90-minute to 2-hour delta, and they're saying with these normal sensitivity troponins a 3 to 6 hour. I don't know, whatever, that's kind of splitting hairs, but I actually do a lot of 2 troponins, and those are patients who I actually think might have ACS, or they present right after their symptom onset. You know, and I'm like, you know, I really want to risk stratify that patient. I do a lot of 2 troponins, and I do about a 2-hour protocol. And even those patients, you know, who I think that ischemic heart pain is a possibility, I will send a lot of those patients home after their negative second troponin with good follow up. So, I mean, there's chest pain and there's chest pain, right? There's if you have a good story or like a moderately good story, I think getting 2 troponins separated by a reasonable amount of time is the way to go. And you know, this whole thing, and I hear this on multiple kind of FOMED sort of podcast blog of sphere, you know, there's a lot of beating down the trope, you know, like if I don't think they have ACS, you know, I'm just not going to get a trope. And I think that's a little bit too pedantic. I mean, there's a lot of people who have...
It's ballsy is what it is.
It sure can be. I mean, the fact is that this is not a bolt in the chamber. This is a low risk patient population. You know, less than 2% of people who come to the ED with chest pain overall ruling in for MIs. And then subsequently, if you do a history in a physical exam, you know, that risk gets incrementally lowered. And if you do an EKG, that risk gets incrementally lowered. And if you do a troponin, that risk gets lowered even further. And then, of course, if you do your deltas the way that these guys are talking about, then their risk becomes, you know, quote unquote, acceptable. But the fact is there's a lot of people with just, you know, weakness, dizzy, vague stuff, chest pain that's, you know,
upper abdominal pain,
sure,
nausea.
I feel like I'm at a confession here, honestly. Like, I feel like, you know, I'm going to go to the pearly gates and they're going to be like, Dr. Josephy, you ordered a single troponins in your career. Explain yourself.
I do plenty of single troponins. I have no problem doing so. I also view it as just another risk stratification tool.
Yep.
Every situation is different. If they just had pain that started 20 minutes ago and the pain is somewhat concerning, and I'm not going to do a single troponin. In my experience, I don't get a lot of false positives on these really low risk patients, and I don't feel like I'm always kicking myself for ordering troponin, and I don't think that it hurts me. I think that it just incrementally helps me. I will say that this comes from using just a standard modern troponin. We do not use the ultra-high-sensitive troponins. So if you have those at your facility, we might be having a different conversation when you're getting many, many false positives.
Yeah.
And I will say that I thought it a bit odd to say that if my history doesn't suggest a cardiac problem, I'm not going to order troponin at all. I just found that a bit surprising in modern, you know, practice. And I don't practice for lawyers or anything like that, but, you know, if you don't order troponins on people with chest pain, and I'm not talking about the 20-year-old with chest pain, but, you know, the 40 to 50-year-old who is probably pretty low risk, because in my mind, there's a difference between low risk and ultra low risk or no risk.
Yeah.
But, you know, even the 40-year-old with a weird kind of vague story, I'm going to routinely order troponins on that patient.
Yep.
And every once in a while, you will surprise yourself and pick up real disease, not a false positive.
So moving on to the last topic, which I think is probably the biggest, is the STEMI. You know, Jared, you asked the specific question, you know, do you lyse or do you transfer if you can, you know, if you can get them there within 90 minutes. The interesting thing is in 2013, the AHA came out and said 90 minutes, you know, that might be, let's push it to 120 minutes. And that
from
had
first medical contact.
From first medical contact, and that had implications on us because that almost made it seem more possible.
Absolutely. I can absolutely get that person on a helicopter to the PCI facility and they can have the balloon up within 2 hours.
Sure.
Now,
but maybe not 90 minutes.
Floored with these new guidelines that, you know, talk about the onset of symptoms as being part of the equation as well, because if I'm not mistaken, if the symptoms are less than 2 hours onset, they recommended lysis if you can't get them to a PCI center within 60 minutes. And we are right on that borderline if you're flying that patient.
Yep.
And I got to say, it's going to require getting the helicopter right away, getting a them hot loaded, having no delay in getting to PCI, we're going to be really, really, really close each time getting that balloon up.
I personally like that this new guideline is incorporating patient characteristics for the first time. I think that's a move in the right direction, and there's been data that has suggested that patients who are younger, patients who have anterior infarcts, and patients who present early in their MI basically have more to lose from delays. There's a fairly large background knowledge base in this for the AHA to come out and modify their guidelines to include some patient characteristics such as symptoms onset, I think is a move in the right direction. Previously, I was in the habit of pushing for lytics in patients who present very early, and then in 2013, when they bumped the time frame out to 120 minutes to balloon, I felt like I could get them to PCI. And the fact is, if you ask most of my partners, they will tell you that they pick up the phone and call cardiology and frequently are told to withhold lytics and just send for PCI. This new guideline seems to be a shift from pushing for primary PCI to pushing for fibrinolysis in those patients who present early. So, you know, we're going to have to sit down with our interventionalists in the area and get a feel for how this guideline update might modify some of our current practices.
For me, STEMIs and strokes are by far two of the most anxiety-provoking presentations that we get. I used to work at a tertiary care center where we had a stroke team and we had a cath lab, and those were the easiest patients.
Oh,
for
man.
Me. You diagnose a STEMI.
8 minutes.
Yeah. You call the code STEMI, cardiology's down there, the patient is whisked away.
Yeah.
Same thing with a stroke. You call the stroke team, you got like a whole cadre of neurologists and residents at the patient's bedside, and they're just going to take it from there. And you can kind of check out.
Yeah.
It's not an anxiety-provoking thing, whereas giving thrombolysis for a stroke without a neurology backup or giving...
Scary.
Or deciding whether or not to thrombolyse or transfer somebody when the transfer times are very borderline, that to me is just exceptionally difficult. In our situation, we're right on that cutoff where we might be able to get them there in time, but there's, you know, if there's any delay, there's a good chance that we're going to miss our target, and if they have a bad outcome because of that, it's going to be second guess. I think wherever you work, you want to get it straight in your head what you're going to do with these patients when you see them, because you certainly don't want to be making these decisions in the heat of the moment. Yep. I've told myself, if we're not flying and the weather's bad, I'm certainly not going to be able to get these patients to the PCI center
No way. In
time with ground transport, so I'm going to lyse all those patients 100% of the time.
Yep.
I do agree now, especially with these new guidelines, that, you know, if you get a really hot MI that's less than 60 minutes of symptoms, that it would be worthwhile lysing those patients. Be mindful of contraindications.
Yes.
Should be one of the first things you ask your patient, you know, the minute you're, whether they're a stroke patient or they're a STEMI lysis patient, like get the checklist.
That's
out.
That's all you ask.
Go through, you're asking for contraindications.
Cool. I have never given lytics to a stroke. Mike, on the other hand, is...
Just did it the other day.
Yeah, he's a spokesperson for Genentech. Anyway, guys, I think that's about all we have to say. You got anything else, Mike?
No, I think that pretty much covered it. Again, I applaud you guys for taking this on. I think you're doing a great thing with the podcast. I've been enjoying it. Keep up the good work.
Yeah, man. We'll talk to you guys later.
All you guys.
Look forward to the next segment. Thanks a lot for your hard work, guys.
Cheers.